accession number 18199, Reel 2.
Okay. Wrong lobby, Reel 2.
Right, so I put down for the depot, which meant an overseas posting, but not very many did. But what was quite surprising, they then asked for volunteers for paratroop training. And it's surprising how many people did step forward for that. Now, okay, it has its appeal, but you know, I did want to go abroad. And if you took up paratraining, you would go to Aldershot for about another 6 weeks, just solid PT, so we were told. So I turned it down. I regret it in a way. I do regret it. I'll probably tell you why later. But I did regret not doing it. But anyway, after an embarkation leave, I went to the depot at Pocklington in Yorkshire. And after a few weeks there, probably 2-3 weeks, I was then posted to the Far East. And I went on the Empole Windrush via Portside, Aden, Colombo, a couple of days shore leave in Colombo. And my first posting was Far Elf, Royal Signals Far Elf, which was at Tanglin in Singapore. But we were only on a holding regiment. We weren't part of the regiment, so we didn't qualify for the Malaya medal or anything like that. And some of the fellows were sent up to KL, Kuala Lumpur, and the rest of us just stayed in Singapore for a little while doing various little jobs. The one thing that I'll always remember from that was one particular day, the 12 of us were to report to the guard room as a special escort duty, and we went down to the guard room, and there was a staff sergeant from the Royal Military Police there. Well, you know, terrified the military police. But he seemed quite a nice chap and chatting to us. He said, "Oh, I've got a little job for you lads." He said, "Well, pile in this truck," and off we went. And we went down to Singapore docks. When we got there, he got out and he said, "Well, I'll tell you why we're here now, lads." He said, "See the troop ship out there?" And he pointed out, and there was the Dunera was out there, and some like landing barges circling around it. And he said, "There's four prisoners on there." He said, "They're being transferred from Korea," he said, "to my little Nick here on the island." He said, "You're the escorts." And we thought, God, you know, been in the army about 6 months, all about 18, you know. And we said, "Oh, you know, imagine a load of hard cases coming off a boat, you know, probably sort us all out." And he said, "Oh," he said, "I'm not expecting any trouble." He said, "When we get them ashore," he said, "just form a loose circle around them." He said, "If they try to make a break for it," he said, "don't make them look silly or anything in front of the natives," he said, "but if they try and make a break for it," he said, "well, you know what you've got to do." He said, "but I don't think I will." He said, "no problem." So we got to the troop ship and it was unloading some wounded, and they were French, from the French battalion in Korea, and presumably either taken to hospital in Singapore or being flown home, I don't really know. And he looked round, and there was one chap, was a massive fella, a chap called Rogers, and he was absolutely huge. And he said, "You," he said, "and you," he pointed to me. He said, "you come with me." He said, "oh, yeah." And he said, "you two are the biggest and ugliest." He said, "come aboard with me as you're my personal escorts." And I thought, God, I'm not that big. But I looked around at the others and I was. But anyway, we got up on there and went into the bowels of the ship. And we was handed these four prisoners. And three of them were from the Ulster Rifles, and one was an Arimi. And I said to SSM, I said, "what?" He said, "mutiny, 15 years, he said. Oh, God. But he said it in such a way, I think, that he was more saying to me, "shut up, it's nothing to do with you, you know." But all these guys were reservists, I would imagine, who had medals. And what went through my mind was that some little young lieutenant had asked them to do this and asked them to do that, and had said, you know, "no way, don't be stupid," but I don't really know the full story. Anyway, it was no trouble, but we took them back to the prison. And I remember he said, we backed in, like a double gate, we backed in, they got out. we went out, and he came out again. So thanks very much, Les. He said, now I'm out to make them bastards jump about a bit. And we thought, oh dear, you know, he seemed such a nice bloke. But we were all so quiet on the way back to the signals camp. Anyway, from there, I was then posted to Hong Kong. And I went on HMS Warrior, which was a light fleet carrier. We were part of the crew, treated as part of the crew. We had to paint the AT-AT guns. And in Hong Kong, we went to the Signals Regiment in Hong Kong itself, Victoria Barracks, I think it was called. And then we were told we'd be posted or out or given jobs on the island. And we also asked if any of us wanted to volunteer for Korea. So, for reasons I think are a bit stupid now, but I said, yeah, I would. So I volunteered for Korea, and I was sent to 14 Field Signal Troop, which is Tactical Artillery Regiment, at that time at Sikon in New Territories.
What days have we reached now?
We've reached, it was July, yeah, I would say July, maybe August, early August, possibly. 1952. Mm-hmm.
52?
So, sorry, 51. Beg your pardon, 51. So we'd sent to this troop, and there was about 36 men in the signal troop. There was an officer, Lieutenant Watson, a sergeant. I won't tell you his name for reasons you may find out later. And was a corporal in charge of each section. That's the radio operators, linesmen, radio mechanics, and drivers, and also a cipher corporal, which is a full corporal's job. And it was quite a good time in Hong Kong. I quite enjoyed it. And we were working up to go to Korea, and we're doing a lot of exercises and so on. There was always one big divisional exercise that you took part in, which was quite frequent. It's probably every 2 or 3 weeks it used to seem to be. And this was the usual. It was always the same exercise. The Chinese had come over the border, and you virtually had a fighting retreat back to Kowloon, which is on the other side of Hong Kong Island. And it was about a 2-3 day exercise, just a delaying retreat, really. And this exercise took place several times. It was always a standard exercise. We never ever advanced and captured China. And then eventually our orders came for sailing to Korea, and we were given the new webbing, the paratrooper webbing, as they used to call it. And we left for Korea about the 28th of October, and we arrived in Busan on the morning of the 3rd of November. Very early in the morning, all excited, we all got up to have a look around, and the first thing that struck us was, moored on the other side of the harbour from us, was a hospital ship, all lit up, Italian, pristine white. You know, crikey, that's a good start. Anyway, eventually we disembarked, and we had the usual speeches of welcome. The colonel of the regiment was given a bouquet of flowers by his little Korean girl. It was Lieutenant Colonel Slade Powell, was the colonel, 14th Field Regiment, and played off by an American band, played the St. Louis Blues March, you know, and marched to the station in Busan. Well, the first thing that struck you was Hong Kong, Singapore, Colombo, Aden, particularly dockside, and also portside, you know, dockside, where there had been a British influence. The buildings were tidy and neat and smart, streets were wide, but the thing that struck you about Busan, it was nothing like that at all. It was just a jumble, you know, an absolute mess, you know. Dusty and dirty, dingy. And we got on this train, which was one of these sort of big American type trains, and it had been knocked about a bit. There were machine gun bullet holes in the roof and burnt marks and that sort of thing. And you just stepped on these bunks, and And as we pulled out, a hospital train was coming in the other way, full of Americans mostly. And they were the lightly wounded ones, of course, were standing on the platforms, and they saw who we were. They were giving us a bit of a shellacking. Your turn next, buddy, you know, you in 6 weeks' time, buddy, you know, waving his bandaged arm in the air. You know. So, you know, you knew you was going somewhere then. And as you went up country, first of all, it was, hadn't been touched by the war. But it was so disadvantaged, you know, it was such a poor case. It's like England must have been in about 1300, something like that. There was no mechanical devices or anything. You just saw ox carts. The huts were all mud and wattle with straw roofs. People just dressed in simple garments. I should imagine that anyone coming from the UK, straight from the UK, probably wasn't so bad for us. We've been in Hong Kong, we knew something of the Orient. But from anyone coming straight from the UK or from America, it must have been quite a culture shock, really. Particularly America, I should think. Anyway, eventually we reached Seoul. Quite a long, slow journey. And we were just holed up in Seoul overnight because you had to go over the only bridge, which was left over the River Han, which was a railway bridge, and it was very precarious. You had to go across very, very slowly. It had been knocked about a bit. It was the only bridge left standing. And you went over that the next day and eventually reached a place called the Weijongbu, which is the railhead. Seoul itself was devastated. It was in ruins. On the north bank of the river was an industrial area where there had been some factories, but the factory was all completely wrecked. The only thing that was actually standing was the chimney stacks, and they were the only things left, nothing else. And when we got to the railheads, there had been like a marshalling yards there. We couldn't go any further, and you could see why. These marshalling yards had been shot up, and these huge great engines, you know, on their sides, you know, holes through the boilers. You know, couldn't believe the wreckage, you know. And we disembarked there, and we got onto trucks, and we went to a place called Britannia Camp, just down the road. And while we were there, the Gloucesters were relieved, and they were coming back. And there was truckloads of Gloucesters coming in. It was obviously not the battalion that were in the engine, it was the reliefs. And what quite surprised me, really, was that blokes were getting out of trucks and looking for mates in other companies. And I didn't sort of realise so much then that how isolated you would be in one company or a platoon or something. You wouldn't know what was going on in others, and they were looking for their mates to see if they were all okay, you know. It quite surprised me, that, really. Then after about 3 days there, you could hear the guns, you know, quite clearly. And I suppose it was about 20 miles from the front. But we were there about 3 days, and then we moved straight up into the front. We were tracked up by American lorries. We went over the Imjin River, which was quite exciting, really, because the Imjin had become quite notorious, and it was quite a sight when you first see it, because it's in like two rocky gorges. There's not much water in it at that particular time, but the gorges are quite spectacular, and it was only a pontoon bridge, so we had to go down to the river bank, across the pontoon bridge, and up the other side. It was quite a sight, really. And then we went straight into the line, relieving 45th Field. Straight away, of course, our gunners, you know, they wanted to try the guns out before they got off the trucks. They were banging away with the guns, you know. But we found there was a lot of 45th Field men who hadn't done their time. So the troop, instead of being about 36 men, now became something like about 50. So there was a lot of spare people, we, you know, we didn't really have permanent jobs, and for those first few weeks I didn't really have a permanent job. The incident I'm going to tell you about, the sergeant, he came on the rear party, and we moved several times in the first few days we were there. It's about the time that Hills 217, 317, 227, 355 were being fought over, so we did shift around a little bit, though they were 28 Brigade operations, and we were 29 Brigade at that time. And we were digging some defensive positions in this small wood. And we could hear the sound of machine gunning. And all of a sudden, this plane came roaring over the hill, firing its guns. Because it was an American plane. And we just sort of stopped in amazement, you know. It was guns really firing, they were coming down, or 3/4 mile away, really, nothing near us. But he went, you know, oh, don't know what he's doing, probably clearing his guns, didn't know where he was or what he was. And we suddenly realised the sergeant was missing. And it wasn't until some time later he came back out of this wood, you know, quite shaken and nervous, and said to us, "Why didn't you take cover?" So, well, you know, we just didn't think. It was just happened too quickly, and we didn't realise what was going on. So we said, "Well, you should take cover, you should take cover." He said, "Air strikes, they're terrible things, terrible things." And where he'd been throwing his weight about a lot before and rather threatening towards us, he then changed completely. And he had a good World War II record. He'd been SAS in World War II, you know, had the SAS wings. But I think it just something had come back to him. It was just too much, you know. And we were all kids, so he was an experienced soldier. And he was relieved the next morning. He was sent, I never saw him again. And then the corporal in charge of the radio operators, Corporal Hardy, he was promoted to sergeant. And during this time, I was, for a while, I was the 2IC's operator. And he had a Dingo, which is a Morris armoured car with a Daimler engine. It's got four gears forward and four backwards, which is just as well because the 2IC's job is to find gun locations. And in this particular time, we were going up a valley. We were following a stream bed. And the stream bed opened up into quite a large pond. So he carried on driving into this pond, and all of a sudden the vehicle just dipped, literally at an angle of 45 degrees, and we were just going down. And all I could see out the side was water. But he slammed the thing into reverse and shot out, you know, like a cork out of a bottle, which was just as well. And he said, "Oh, we can't go that way," he said. And on another occasion, we had to go on an exercise, well, not an exercise, an operation is the word really, where the infantry, I think that's in the Welsh regiment, no, sorry, we going to the Welsh regiment position. I think they were Norfolks, had to go across the back valley, which was called Purple Heart Valley in our area, which separated us from the Chinese, take some hills on the opposite side, and our guns would then move up to an earlier, sorry, a nearer position to the front that they were normally, so they could fire on targets normally outside their range. So, anyway, I had to get up about 2 in the morning, given a cup of lukewarm tea and a bit of greasy bacon, sort of thing. And we had to be on the start line about 3 or 4 in the morning, and we were in this valley with the infantry positions on the top of the hill, the front nine positions. And he went up to an OP, and I had to run a remote control line from the radio set. It was number 19 radio set up to the OP, and I suppose it was still about 5, 6 in the morning. Anyway, whatever happened, I don't know. It's not my probably business to be told, but something went wrong anyway, and the whole thing collapsed. And he came back downhill in a bit of a temper, and he said, "Oh, undo the remote control. We've got to go to Div HQ." Undone it, come down. And we drove back to Div HQ, and we went back. I wasn't even going back through these lines of infantrymen trudging back, and they were looking really downcast, I suppose, whatever that and they'd done, they fouled it up, and they knew it, I think. And you could see that they were looking really miserable and glaring at us, you know, let's just say, blooming officers, you know, that's down or something. Anyway, got back to Div HQ, and it was still quite early in the morning, and there were other drivers there, the CO's driver was there, and the officers all got out and went into an O group and left us in the car park. And of course, the Div HQ is also the HQ of the Signals Regiment, which has an RSM and a CO and so on. And we all lounging about by these trucks or jeeps, or in our case, a dingo. Radios were switched off. And suddenly I heard a voice, "Hey, you there, signalman, come here." Look around. So I said, "What does he mean?" Somebody saw him. He means you, doesn't he? Because there were other signals guys there. I was the only one that had a berry on with a signals badge. It's the RSM of the signals regiment. He said, "What do you think you're doing?" He said, "What do you think you're doing lounging about like that? Have you shaved this morning? Have you cleaned your boots? Have you done this?" And God, you know, I can't believe this is happening to me, you know. And I just felt so tired and dirty and dispirited that I wasn't sort of saying anything. I was just saying, He said, "I've shaved this morning. I've cleaned my boots. I've done this. I've done that. Why can't you?" How do you explain to him, you know? I just couldn't. I just said nothing. And with that, I suddenly realised that the O group had broken up. And the major, who I see, was standing just behind me. And he said, "I'm sorry, Major." He said, "Thank you very much." He says, "I'll take over now." I said, "All right." He says, "Get back to the Jeep." So Dingo, he said, "Start the radio up and tell him we're coming back in a few minutes." And as I walked back to the Jeep, I looked back, and he was telling the Sergeant Major off. You know, he got his swagger stick in his hand, pointing to the front, pointing to me, pointing there. And the Sergeant Major was stiffening up. "Sir, salute," bang, off he went. The Major came back to the dingo, and he got in and said, "Right, we're going home now." I didn't say anything, I just looked at him, you know, and he looked at me. And it was like a mutual sort of look went between us, much as to say, "Well, don't worry, son, I told him what you were up to." Because this time, it wasn't really winter yet, it was still autumn. And though it was very, very cold at night, it was reasonably warm and sticky in the day. And the roads would freeze up at night. So if you went out early in the morning, you were going down rutted, frozen roads. And but by the time you came back, say 10 or 11 o'clock when the sun was up a little bit, they then turned into mud and you just slid and slided in all over the place. And on one occasion we had to move our trucks out of one location to another, which meant going up an incline, and it was just liquid mud, and we had to take the trucks up by driving two stakes in at the top of the hill, and you put ropes back down round the back axle of the trucks, and then the truck revved up. As he revved up, so it went on the back axle and it sort of jacked it up the hill. But of course, you all had to push as well. And every time it would stick and the mud would flow out the back, we just got absolutely covered in mud and filthy, you know. And this happened. It was all day getting these trucks up, and the state we were in at the end of it all. Unbelievable. But then it started to get, it was really cold, and it would stay frozen all day, but there was still no snow. And it was one day, about this time, I suppose this was about possibly early December, a rumour went round that the peace talks had been signed and the armistice. And it was a strange thing, because no guns were firing, whereas normally you could hear guns firing down the front somewhere. And this particular morning it was uncanny, it was this eerie silence everywhere, and everyone seemed to have heard the same rumour. But of course, it was then found out it wasn't a rumour at all. It wasn't true. It wasn't true. It was a rumour. And the guns were banging away again. But it was quite a strange day, that. Quite curious. As the cold weather came, the 2IC decided that he wanted a weatherised Jeep rather than the dingo, which was open to the elements. And he could do with his own driver, which was an artillery driver. So I was made redundant there. I went to TAC HQ for a while, which was with the brigade, 29 Brigade, and the CO was there, but I didn't get on too well with him. I was still a bit cheeky at times. Back answer things and things like that. And he didn't like that, naturally. So he sent me back to Regimental HQ, and so we had so many operators, and the word came from 28 Brigade that they were short of operators and they were going back in the line. And myself and another chap who I'd known actually since basic training days, he was in the same troop with me, a chap called Stuart, came from Liverpool, who also a volunteer for Korea. And we were sent to 28 Brigade, who at that time were in reserve. And we were actually opposite Castle Hill, which is the Gloucester's hill. It was actually in a location exactly opposite that hill. And the sergeant there was, communication sergeant was a Sergeant Horton, and the administration sergeant was a Sergeant Modrell. The officer was Captain Webb, who, and the 2IC was the Lieutenant Bohannon, both of whom are still alive, and both became brigadiers. Sergeant Horton, I haven't heard from him in a while, but I was in touch with him up till quite recently, but I didn't get any Christmas card from him at Christmas, so I don't know if he's still okay. I don't like to find out. Anyway, at 28 Brigade, we were told to make a tour of the trucks and have a look around and see what's going on. And rather foolishly, when we got to the command vehicle, there was a 40-line switchboard, 49 F&F switchboard, which we'd operated in Hong Kong. And I rather foolishly, I didn't like being on switchboards, told the operator that I could work one. And he went, oh, can you? And I was then told to report to a Corporal Lauren Martin for duty on the switchboard. And I was very reluctant. I didn't want to go on the switchboard. And I argued a bit about it. I said, well, you know, I'm a radio operator. I did 6 months training to be one, not 6 weeks to be a switchboard operator. And a job that a rat can do. So, well, yeah, but we haven't got any switchboard operators and we haven't got any racks either. This bloke told me the same thing and he's done his turn and now it's your turn, get on it.
What's a rack?
Women's World Army Corps. And so on the switchboard I went. Now, Christmas Day I was on duty and I joined them about a week before Christmas, I suppose. And I was duty operator Christmas Day. You used to do a 24-hour shift, which you broke off. You had 2 hours off for dinner, 4 hours off in the evening. And then you had the complete next day off. And then the next day you were relief operator for those 2 hours and 4 hours that the other chap had for meals and so on. So I was woke up quite early in the morning by Sergeant Horton, who gave me a cup of tea with some rum in it and some of them little tiny biscuits with sugar lumps on it. Merry Christmas, Larby. Merry Christmas, Sergeant. And I pushed my way out of the tent, pushed my rifle out, and it was starting to snow. It was a sleety snow, and the wind was coming down much, much stronger than it had ever been before. So as the day went on, that sleet became more and more snowy. It got colder and colder, and the wind got up and up. And I was relieved for dinner, and the Captain Heather, who was the camp commandant, he was an Enniskillen Fusilier. He greeted you at the door with a bottle of beer, you know, as Japanese beer. Really had your meal, and McDonald, General, Brigadier General McDonald, he was the